Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Once an obscure niche of the investment world, private equity has grown into a juggernaut with consequences for a wide range of industries as well as financial markets. Private equity funds control companies representing trillions of dollars in assets, millions of employees, and the well-being of thousands of institutional investors, their beneficiaries, and pension fund holders. Even as the ruthlessness of some funds has made equity, private equity, a poster child for the harms of unfettered capitalism, many aspects of the industry remain opaque, hidden from the normal bounds of accountability.
The myth of private equity is a hard-hitting and meticulous exposé from an insider's viewpoint. Jeffrey Hook, a former private equity executive and investment banker with deep knowledge of the industry, examines the negative effects of private equity and the ways in which it has avoided scrutiny. Jeffrey Hook is a senior lecturer in finance at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. His books include M&A, A Practical Guide to Doing the Deal, and Security Analysis on Wall Street, A Comprehensive Guide to Today's Valuation Methods. He has decades of experience as an investment banker and as a private investment executive at major firms. Jeffrey, thank you for joining Mountain Money this morning.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
I'm going to start off with just an overview question, I guess, and that's, why did you feel the need to write the book, and how long did it take you to write it?
Well, I may have a higher sense of social responsibility than some ex-investment bankers, but I had seen in some of my research for nonprofits and taxpayer groups that a lot of these big state pension funds really weren't cutting it from an investment point of view. I thought it had to be exposed, so my career is kind of over, and so I wasn't worrying about being blackballed by Wall Street, so I thought I could do it. It took me about 9 months to write it, and then the book has to be edited by the publisher, and you get comments from outside parties, so it takes 4 or 5 months to go through the editing process, and then, of course, it's bound and printed and put in the warehouse.
By the way, the book is a surprisingly fun read, given the subject matter. And one of the things you do is you bring things to life in a couple of interesting ways. You start with a story about the state of Maryland's pension fund. I think that's an example for you of why it is so important that we look at the performance of private equity. Tell us a little bit about that story and share with the audience what it told you about the approach they're taking.
Well, I'm from Maryland, so I was first introduced to the state pension funds and their obsession with private equity a number of years ago when I was working for a taxpayer group, and I saw all the waste and malfeasance, at least from the private equity point of view. And there was a big disconnect between, I thought, the board of directors of the pension fund and the beneficiaries. So the board of directors were shelling out hundreds of millions in Wall Street fees for performance that was pretty mediocre. A pension fund couldn't even beat a simple index fund. And that's really what got me started. I actually went to a couple of meetings of the Board of Trustees. If anybody can walk in there, it's a public-type meeting, and I was just frustrated at how passive and how sort of inward-looking the Board of Trustees were, despite the fact they were not really doing so well.
Obviously, they're obligation is to balance risk and reward, but to try to get the best returns it can with safety for its pension holders. Why is it that pension funds generally have gravitated to private equity in the first place?
Well, I think a lot of your listeners may think that, well, all these big pension funds and Wall Street investment funds are run by people from Harvard and Wharton, and that's true. But there's a lot of copycat. So a few early initiators, the private equity investment phase, sort of had some real success back in the 90s. And then as the 2000s closed in, people looked at how successful they were and basically tried to copy them. But of course, when people start copying each other and jump headfirst into an industry like private equity, the prices for the investment goes up, and then, of course, the returns drop. So even though the early investors did quite well, as time has shown, the later investors did not do so well. And it was all started by the state of Washington, state of Oregon, and Yale University. They were the first adopters.
I want to admit that prior to picking up this book, I did not know much about private equity, and the book gave me a really good background. But I'd like you to kind of walk us through, how does private equity work?
Sure. Well, a lot of people think, you know, finance or investments is kind of a dry subject, particularly these exotic niches, as you pointed out in your intro, which are a lot confidential by their very nature. But the way private equity works is not all that complicated. In big investors, mostly institutional investors like state pension plans or university endowments, think that they got to try something new in order to beat the stock market. So they invest with these funds that buy into private companies. So these private companies don't have stocks that are on the stock exchange like Amazon or Exxon. And so the idea is, well, since everything's private, maybe we can find some bargains out there. So many people have jumped in that there are no bargains. But the initial idea was, we'll go into something new. It's exotic. People haven't discovered it yet. We'll get higher returns. But private equity doesn't kind of work that way anymore. It used to 15 or 20 years ago. And, you know, your investors basically break down the private equity industry into three categories. There's venture capital, which we've kind of all heard about because so many high-tech companies have gone public. There's venture capital, which is a small percentage. It's only about 20% of the business. There's something called growth capital, which is sort of similar to venture capital. Most of the business is leveraged buyouts, where these big funds take over companies, as kind of mentioned in your intro, but they borrow a lot of money and try to enhance their returns through a lot of leverage.
When an LBO,
whoops,
When an LBO works and it works well to the success of the fund, what happens? They buy the company, they add debt. What is it that allows the investor to make money?
It's sort of like buying a house. Let's say you're a house flipper. You know, you buy a house for $500,000 and you flip it, you know, a few years later for $600,000, you got a $100,000 profit. If you borrowed most of the money in the first place and say you only had $100,000 in equity, then you had 100% profit. You invested $100,000, you got back $200,000 on your equity investment. The private LBO or leveraged buyout business is no different. The more debt you put in, if things work out, the higher your return on equity. So the whole idea is simply putting in a little extra debt, well, maybe a lot of extra debt, and then your equity return will jump. It'll be higher than the stock market if things work out. Of course, leverage is a two-edged sword. If the value of the asset were to drop a little bit, then the equity investment that you put in is entirely wiped out because the debt has first priority. So in general, you know, the idea is if you could leverage your investments and things work out well, you're going to beat the stock market by 4 or 5 points. Unfortunately, in real life, it hasn't worked that way, and it hasn't worked that way for 10 or 15 years. It's all been a mirage, smoke, and mirrors.
And that's what I began to understand as I read the book. As you had said, the philosophy worked a long time ago, or when it first came out, and that was that these funds were given and businesses were bought, and they were looking for the efficiencies. How could we make these businesses run better? How can we improve them? But as you've said, there's no more deals left yet. You know, there is a whole industry out there making calls, trying to find these businesses just to keep everything going and have more things to invest in.
Yeah, that's true. So the myth, normally in an efficient, what we call an efficient Wall Street type market, you know, once an investment funds or a group of managers' results become substandard, they're out of business. But the private equity market is a little different, mainly because the results, the companies they buy, you know, how they supposedly improve them, is all kind of secret. It's called private equity for a reason. A lot of the results, a lot of the numbers are private and confidential, almost like, say, the nuclear codes that President Biden carries about. So this persistence of confidentiality and secrets is just allow the myth to be perpetuated. And you might say, well, what about other crises or things that blew up, like Enron, for example, you know, blew up because, you know, a lot of the numbers it proposed and shown people were phony. But, you know, that was a publicly traded company. The numbers were kind of out there in the open. It took a while for people to figure them out. With private equity, everything's sort of behind a curtain.
One of the things about private equity funds that you bring out that I think are important are the unique characteristics of the relationships between the people who are putting up the money, the people who invest in the fund, and the organization, the investment bank or the PE organization that administers it. You point out that there's typically a 10-year window. You point out that they start taking fees from the beginning. Talk a little bit about, you know, the way in which even substandard performance has resulted in massive profits to the PE fund firms.
So what you got to remember is that a PE fund, a private equity fund, has a 10-year life. That means the managers have a 10-year no-cut contract, which would be far better than even one of the best pro athlete contracts. So they cannot get fired, whether they make money or lose money for the investors. It's kind of a weird situation, which I've never quite understood. So they've got a 10-year no-cut contract. They're going to get paid fees that are much higher than what your listeners would pay on a mutual fund or for a 401k plan. The fees are 3 or 4% a year, so they're extremely high. And yet the results, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, are mediocre at best. So you might say, well, why do the customers do it? You know, why do these big institutions persist in buying this stuff if it doesn't really perform, if you're paying all these high fees and nothing good happens? Well, that's sort of a corporate governance or what we might call a fiduciary problem, where the managers of the endowment or the manager of the state pension plan say, well, I got to make my job sound really complicated. So I can't just buy publicly traded stocks or publicly traded bonds. Then it seems like it's easy. I won't get paid $2 million a year. So what they try to do is they make it sound complicated. They buy all these exotic investments like private equity and hedge funds and commodity funds, and that way they can justify a much higher compensation. It's a very cynical outlook, but it certainly worked. If you look at, say, the compensation of the chief investment officer of the Ford Foundation, that compensation is quintupled in the last 20 years because these investment officers can say, look, everything's so complicated. I got to get paid more and have a huge staff.
So as you're explaining, you know, there are people who are in this industry who can or do perpetuate this because it helps them stay either well paid in their job or what have you. But there's also other enablers. You know, as you mentioned with regards to the fees, they're private. And yet, you know, state pension plans like California's admitted they have no idea what they're paying in fees. How did these regulations get relaxed, or how did more enforcement, or how is now enforcement not happening?
Well, as I'm sure people have, you know, listeners have read in the paper, seen in the media, these private equity guys are supposed to be geniuses. Of course, the facts speak otherwise. They don't do that well. Can't even beat the public stock market. Now, getting back to your question, these private equity titans, you've heard some of their names, they make worth billions of dollars. They sit at the top of the mountain, but they're not loaners. As you point out, they have a lot of helpers or enablers to allow them to perpetuate the myth. And, you know, that would include the customers themselves who need complicated investments to justify their jobs. But there's also the accounting business, which allows state pension funds like California to not even know what they're paying. There's laws in most states that say that the state pension plans do not have to disclose what they're paying in terms of private equity fees. And interestingly, a lot of them do not even ask the private equity funds what the fees are. I did a poll with an assistant of mine for a study, and we polled 35 states, and only 4 or 5 knew what the fees were that they were paying. I mean, how many people out there would pay an electricity bill without knowing how much electricity they use? So it's very odd. I mean, then you have some other enablers besides the accounting profession and the state legislatures. The federal government itself is one of the biggest enablers. We have something called the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is supposed to protect people from getting fleeced. But they are so totally on the sidelines. So you've had a huge private equity business, as you mentioned, trillions in assets, millions of employees, but it gets a free ride from the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's no sheriff in town. There's no cop on the beat. It's virtually totally unregulated. So when these private equity people run around saying, oh, I'm returning 20 or 25% a year, no one is there to stop them and say, well, wait a second, that's really not true.
That segues to an interesting point that I found in the book, which is where you were discussing results and how results are characterized. Talk a little bit about how the various private equity funds represent their results and how it is that they market to purchasers. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was that, you know, the results are often represented in quartiles, and somehow 75% of the funds seem to be able to market themselves as being in the top quartile. How's that work?
Don't you wish you could do that with your own job?
Lake will
be gone. Put yourself in the top quartile. Yes. So the idea is, and this is fact, that, you know, I'm not making this up, that some people may think it's crazy. The most returns, which is the returns that seem to beat a public stock market index, are in the top 25%. The rest, the other 75%, do not beat the stock market. So that whole situation upside down. So everybody's trying to run into the top quartile and say, well, that's where I'll get my returns if I go into the top quartile. So a lot of the funds use sleight of hand to say, well, if you use this measurement technique, I'm in the top quartile. And so it's a little bit, as you mentioned, it's sort of like Garrison Keillor's fictional Lake Wobegon, where every student, every kid is above average. That's kind of the situation in private equity. Since there's no referee, they can all say they're in the top quartile. So, I mean, you couldn't do that on the baseball field where, you know, some batter says, well, I'm the top batter because, you know, it's all out there in the open. But I said here it's kind of secret. And so it's very tough for outsiders who want to investigate, or even for the investors themselves, to do the proper due diligence to see if someone is truly in the top quartile.
One thing that we've been focusing on is how these investments impact the investors. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how private equity hurts consumers and companies, and wondering if you could go through the $6 billion Safeway supermarket chain deal and just kind of give an overview of how it hurts others too.
Well, the Safeway deal, which was done about 20 years ago, and of course Safeway has recovered and it's now a very well-established supermarket chain. It's very healthy. It's publicly traded. But 20 or so years ago, it was, or maybe 25 years ago, it was taken private. It was turned from a public company into a private company. It was bought by these leveraged buyout funds. And they crippled the company. They piled a lot of debt on the company to get a quick return with some cash. A lot of stores were closed. Workers' pay was cut. And a lot of workers, over 50,000, were fired, all with a greater goal of boosting returns and paying off this debt. And so, I mean, that's just one case out of many, but these cases trying to tend to draw a lot of publicity. I mean, everybody we know, you know, we've all shopped at Toys R Us. You know, a similar thing happened to Toys R Us. A lot of debt was piled on. It couldn't reinvest in the stores. The stores were dirty. They didn't have enough inventory. Eventually, the company went bankrupt. So there's a laundry list of companies that this has happened to. And in fact, out of 10 companies taken through an LBO, taken private through LBOs, 30% go bankrupt. So it's not like they've got some kind of magic formula. A lot of these companies go under. So people lose their jobs, just average people. And yet, interestingly, the way the fee's set up, you can still make millions as a private equity manager, even if 30% of your companies go down the toilet. It's a very, you know, it's kind of a great arrangement for them. It's not so great for the consumers who like shopping at Toys R Us or Safeway.
So we pointed out a lot of the sort of flaws in the way in which PE firms market to pension funds. Talk a little bit about the kinds of reforms that you would like to see in terms of disclosure, in terms of standardization of performance, in terms of standardization of mark-to-market, those kinds of things. Let's talk about how, if we had the magic wand and could step up and try to fix it, and I know you resisted doing this in the book, what kinds of things would we do?
Well, in any case, you know, an investment asset class like private equity is going to be much more responsive if everything's out there in the sunlight. So what you suggested is totally true. You'd want to have the investment results made public and disclosed in a fashion that's in plain English, which is, you know, of course, the investment world surrounds itself with all these complicated theories and equations and stuff, but something that's certainly plain English. Here's the rate of return so that people who work at unions, who sit on these pension fund boards, will know what they're paying and what their returns are. And as you alluded, the way the returns are calculated, there's two or three different methods. And, you know, there should be a standardized method, and it should be disclosed. And people have tried these things in the past. You know, a couple of good-hearted legislators that are well-determined to make it a better playing field for the beneficiaries of pension plans and university endowments, they've fallen flat on their face. They've gotten no place fast. The industry now is simply too powerful. They've got too many lobbyists, too many political donations for the wheels of democracy to function properly.
It definitely is a heavy lift, and as we all know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. We've been speaking with Jeffrey Hook. He is the author of a new book, The Myth of Private Equity, An Inside Look at Wall Street's Transformative Investments. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us this morning on Mountain Money. Here in Park City, Friday is Live PC, Give PC. And Live PC, Give PC is a one-day virtual event that encourages all of Summit County, Utah to contribute to benefit our nonprofit organizations through a single online giving platform. While we expect to see donations in the form of dollars on Friday, our nonprofits may soon face a decision to accept cryptocurrency. Virtual currency is gaining mainstream attention with each passing day. Nonprofits such as the American Red Cross, UNICEF, and American Cancer Society leverage platforms, including the Giving Block and other services, to accept a wide range of virtual currencies as part of their overall funding strategies. Here to help us understand this new trend is Jeremy Coffey with Perlman & Perlman. Jeremy, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I am having a hard time hearing you louder.
is that any better?
Yes. There we go. Perfect. Thank you. So, this is kind of a new realm for nonprofits beginning to accept cryptocurrency. Do you have a sense of the growth of the number of donations? And what types of donors typically donate in cryptocurrency?
Well, we don't have a clear sense of the volume or number of donors, but we definitely see peaks in interest and donations, especially major donations that ebb and flow with the value of virtual currency and typically the value of Bitcoin. So in 2017, we saw a tremendous amount of interest when there was a bubble in the crypto markets that was really captured, I think, really well by what was called the Pineapple Fund at the time, an anonymous donor who donated 5,104 bitcoins to various charities around the world, kind of demonstrating a use case for how Bitcoin could contribute to the charitable sector. And then just this past summer, there was also a New York Times article about a $5 million gift to the University of Pennsylvania, again from an anonymous donor. And users of crypto tend to be under 40, I think the majority, vast majority of crypto users, and they tend to have a lot of really substantial unrealized gains. They are sitting on, a lot of them, bitcoins that they acquired for pennies on the dollar relative to their current value, and so when they look to liquidate and take advantage of these bubbles, a charitable donation can be a really useful mechanism for reducing their tax bill.
So if I'm a standard nonprofit, I'm sitting there as the treasurer, and somebody calls me up and says, "Here comes some crypto. What do I do with it? I mean, I have a bank account, but how do I realize the financial gain?"
So that's a really good question, and that's one that we get a lot. So basically, there are two general ways that you can accept crypto. Well, first, what I would say is if you're on the board of a nonprofit, you want to talk to your fellow board members and say, "Hey, do we even want to get involved in this?" From my perspective, the answer should probably be yes. I see very few downsides to accepting cryptocurrency. It's trickier when you get to decide about what to do with it. But from the first instance, As you mentioned in the intro, Allison, there are a number of services now that have popped up that will facilitate nonprofits who want to accept cryptocurrency, such as the Giving Block. And basically, they will provide you with a plugin similar to the donate button that a lot of nonprofits currently have on their website. And that plugin will allow a donor who has a Bitcoin or Ether or any of the other coins, any of the other major coins, I should say, and allow them to donate, and the donation will drop into a wallet in the name of the nonprofit that will be set up on a well-established platform like Gemini Trust. And from there, the nonprofit will decide what to do with the crypto. But first and foremost, the question of whether or not to even go through the process of setting up those accounts is one that the board should take seriously.
Okay, so what would be the considerations that a not-profit board would take into account in evaluating whether or not to accept currency? I mean, my immediate instinct is, hey, it's money. Why wouldn't I take it?
I think most folks would agree with you with that first instance. And I think one of the hesitations and one of the most serious hesitations that boards have is that one of the things that breaks into the news cycle about cryptocurrency is both when the value gets really, really high or when it's used for something illicit. You hear about ransomware attacks where the payments are demanded in Bitcoin or something like that. And so a number of boards, they can't quite articulate, what they think the risk would be to the nonprofit, but they are certainly concerned about the association that they have in their minds of crypto and illicit activity. Now, from my perspective, what I typically walk them through is when you're accepting crypto, even if it is anonymous and so you don't know where it's coming from, it's no different than if you were to, if someone were to offer you, hey, there's a bag of cash of $10,000 out on your doorstep. Do you want to use it, or do you want to just leave it there and not take advantage of it? I think most boards, even if they didn't know where that bag of cash came from, would say, well, we can put it to an important charitable use, and so we're going to take the risk that it, who knows where it came from. Chances are it didn't come from anywhere illicit. I mean, that is a highly unlikely scenario. But that's what the biggest concern the nonprofit boards have that I talk to. And then the second concern that they just have is they don't understand the logistics. And so that's where folks like the Giving Block or other service providers can come in and make it really simple for them.
And does somebody like the Giving Block, do they take a percentage off the top to facilitate all this?
Generally speaking, yes, that's the model. Is they might charge a subscription fee, which is relatively minimal compared to the size of the donations that you're expecting, and then they take a small either percentage or per transaction fee.
When you started talking about the process, I liked how you first started with, well, the treasurer would go talk to the board. So thinking about, the board and their involvement, what other types of policies would a board need to look at with the extreme volatility in cryptocurrency value? Is a policy to immediately liquidate? Is that something they should be looking at?
Absolutely. I mean, we typically encourage nonprofit boards to incorporate Bitcoin into their overarching investment policy. So which we hope that nonprofits, especially ones that are receiving valuable property, they should have something in writing that guides their executives and other folks in their organization about what to do if, Bitcoin is not the only valuable property that someone might offer. Sometimes it's real estate, sometimes it's art, sometimes it's, you name it, something that the nonprofit may be able to take use of or may be able to sell. But overall, you need to give guidance to folks about what they're supposed to do if a generous donor comes and offers you something that you haven't seen before. And so for Bitcoin, generally speaking, we think that the policy should either give the organization and the staff instructions on, okay, if you accept crypto, our policy is either to liquidate it immediately, that way we can hedge against any volatility in the market, or depending on the nonprofit's financial status, whether they are able to take the risk, whether they sort of have a long-term goal for virtual currency, they may say that, we're only going to liquidate 50% of it and we're going to hold the rest. Or they might differentiate between, Bitcoin or other alternate coins that come in. So it really depends on, their familiarity and comfort with cryptocurrency in general, and then their overall goals as an organization and their risk profile.
Boards have a fiduciary obligation, obviously, to carefully shepherd the assets and the resources of the company. Do you think that boards would find risk in holding on to an asset as volatile as Bitcoin? Do you think that's going to sort of mitigate against many boards holding on to it?
I think generally, the volatility in cryptocurrency, there's short-term volatility, but in the long term, it's been on a steady march upward. So if you are working with an organization that has already got a substantial treasury and you're looking at long-term investments, it might not be crazy for the board to say, well, we might want to experiment and see if we can take advantage of the upside that is available with crypto. But it is definitely an organization-specific question. You know, it really depends. I think a lot of nonprofits, especially smaller and mid-sized nonprofits, are not in the financial position to take those kind of risks. And so they will generally adopt a policy that says, you know, we will accept these generous donations and we will just immediately liquidate them so that we, you know, they generally will not be able to wait a month, a year, 2 years to see how the currency appreciates. And so they just want to get out as quickly as possible.
Volatility of the currency is definitely one concern or one risk. Right now, there's really no regulations regarding cryptocurrency. The IRS has recommendations. Should this give any organization pause?
It should give them pause, and they should definitely reach out to an advisor to help them. You know, IRS is sort of, their general guidance is that cryptocurrency should be treated, or cryptocurrency donations should be treated similarly to donations of other property in the way in which donors may be eligible for certain types of tax deductions and whether what their basis would be, depending on when they first acquired the crypto. But I think that the relatively unregulated nature of cryptocurrency companies and platforms, to me at least, is another incentive hedging against, or another incentive against holding on to cryptocurrency long term. Because what we have seen, even in, you know, just taking into account recent months, with the SEC and CFTC taking a number of investigatory or enforcement actions against folks involved in the cryptocurrency markets, has sent certain currencies, you know, on a roller coaster in terms of their value. And so holding on to them and holding on to them with particular platforms might pose an additional risk for organizations. So that might be another reason that you would want to just immediately liquidate.
You know, straightforward mechanical question. I oftentimes when a not-for-profit receives a donation, or basically always, they're obligated to send a letter that says this is the value of what we got. Is there publicly available data that would allow an organization to easily value a crypto donation on a specific date?
Yes. I mean, there are 24/7 markets that are available on a lot of the platforms. You know, we'll give you a valuation in dollars that is available. But, you know, IRS has given a little bit of guidance on this too. And to the extent that these are larger donations, they may require an actual appraisal to make sure that the amount listed both for the donor and on the nonprofit's books, you know, is correct. And so, again, this is fact specific, so nonprofits would want to check with their advisors to see in which situations. But generally speaking, I think it's above $5,000. If you're receiving something of that size, you may need an appraisal. And also, you know, one of the other factors that you just mentioned, the fact that a lot of these donations are anonymous makes some of this receipting a little tricky. You know, the platforms that partner with nonprofits such as the Giving Block try to make this as easy as possible, but they cannot, to my knowledge, put in a sort of filter to confirm identity or require certain parts of that identity to be listed. So a nonprofit may be faced with a situation where it legitimately receives an anonymous donation and has no ability to issue the receipt to a particular individual.
Of course, from the nonprofit's perspective, I don't know that they would care. In other words, from an IRS perspective, because if they don't issue a receipt, nobody's going to take a deduction. What difference does it make from the nonprofit's perspective? It's really interesting what you just said, because I would have thought that at a minimum, you could probably use something like the average of the high-low price on the 24-hour period, the way the IRS allows other kinds of stock donations to be treated, that you can't just do a straightforward high-low, because I guess there's no single market for a cryptocurrency. Is that the reason I can't just do that?
I don't think IRS has specifically said, but I think the reason is because there's no single regulated market.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly.
For, you know, if at some point SEC or CFTC comes in and says, okay, this is the, you know, official Bitcoin marketplace, and therefore we can take these prices. But right now you have a smattering, some very massive marketplaces that I think give a very reliable sense of what the value is on a given date or time. But IRS to date at least has said that we're not going to treat it exactly the same as stock.
We've been focusing on the receipt of the funds, but I want to just go and talk from a donor's point of view. If you were a donor and you're going to donate cryptocurrency, how does that affect, or how does that, your tax return? How does the IRS adjust that?
So IRS has been very eager to try and get people to report more of their cryptocurrency transactions and donations. But generally speaking, it's treated as property. So if you've held it for over a year, it's treated as capital gains property. And so you may be eligible to basically take the fair market value of your donation as the deduction when you make the donation to the nonprofit, which is substantial because otherwise you might be limited to your basis. And some of these folks who were early Bitcoin investors are holding Bitcoin now that is worth, you know, $60,000 a coin. And when they purchased it or, you know, mined it, it might have been worth $1 a coin. And so if they were treated, if they were required to use basis, they would be, you know, only get a tax deduction for that dollar, but then they would have had a, if they've sold any other cryptocurrency that they want to use the deduction against, it's not very useful. Whereas if they're able to get the $60,000 as their deduction, then that is a really useful tool to minimize their other taxable gains.
You know, we've talked about how a not-for-profit would react to someone donating crypto. Have you heard of any not-for-profits being bold enough to affirmatively invest in crypto on their own as part of a diversified investment strategy?
I have not. I mean, we've recently seen that with some for-profit companies, you know, Tesla being the big one that it adds it to its treasury. But I have not yet heard. And I think you earlier identified a lot of the concerns that boards have. And boards of nonprofits tend to be pretty risk averse, and they tend to be really concerned about preserving the nonprofit's assets. So, I think that option would only be available to some of the largest ones who have a real significant financial buffer to hedge against the risk inherent in investing in Bitcoin. And I just haven't seen any of that yet.
I've really appreciated this conversation. With this being our week of our kind of fundraising for all our nonprofits in the community, I think it was a very pertinent discussion. We've been speaking with Jeremy Coffey. He's with Perlman & Perlman, and he just talked with us about cryptocurrency and nonprofits. Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
The Little Gym Park City opened its doors in 2018. The Little Gym of Park City specializes in unique educational classes that revolve around active play. They welcome infants as young as 4 months old and kids up to 12 years old. Joining us this morning is Lena Singleton, the owner of the Little Gym Park City. Good morning, Lena, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, you opened your doors back in 2018. What was your goal and outlook at that time for this business?
Back in 2018, I had two young daughters. They both went to the Little Gym down in Salt Lake City. We moved up to Park City, and I was surprised at the lack of options for the younger kiddos in the area. So as a former Montessori teacher, I wanted to provide something not only for the youngest kiddos, but also in town. There wasn't really anything in town, and we're right on Iron Horse Drive, so that's pretty central.
The Little Gym, it is a franchisor. It's a national brand. How do people know it? Like when it's in a community, what does it bring? What types of programs do you have?
Yes. So I wasn't aware that it was a franchise when my girls went to the one in Salt Lake City. We are non-competitive gymnastics, but we also offer other opportunities for the younger kiddos that are three and up, like camps, and we have our parent survival nights, and we have birthday parties, and coming in November, we're doing our Friday afternoon, what we call power plays.
So if I walked into the gym, what would I see? Tell us a little bit about the facility.
You would see very specific areas designed for each age group. So it's at one gym, it's one space, balance beam, bars, tumbling. Each class is structured to the specific age group and development of the child. So it's just one class at a time. It's a very small space. We start at 4-month-olds and we go up to 10-year-olds.
And so I assume it's not a drop-off at the 4-month-old age. You have parent me classes. What age do those go to? And talk to us about the benefits of going through a class like that with your child.
Yes. So our parent-child classes are 45-minute structured gymnastics classes for the 4-month-olds to the 2-year-olds. And it really focuses on not only body control, but balance and coordination, how to go up and down things safely and land on 2 feet and jumping, all those very what we think as simple things that we do that for the littlest gymnasts, as we call them, it's a big skill, learning how to walk along a balance beam and trust. It's all about trust as well.
So talk a little bit about the role you think that gymnastic skills play in overall development. Why is it important for kids to have exposure to this particular set of disciplines?
Yes, so not only is it important, like I said, for the balance and the body control and spatial awareness, but our programs are designed to promote the independence of the child, the self-confidence. It's a very positive atmosphere. I was a Montessori teacher, so I'm all about promoting each child's individual growth and development, but keeping it positive and fun and exciting. I've had quite a few ski and snowboard instructors tell me how great gymnastics is for the boys in particular, for their ability to be able to know where their body is in space and stop and control and all of that.
I know with kind of the philosophy of long-term athletic development, you know, you want to keep your kids in as many sports as possible until they have to then choose one. You know, just choosing one sport like baseball at five is not necessarily a well-rounded situation for a child. So going through these programs, it will help that kid no matter what they're going into. You say that you've got programs going up till 10 years old and that they're non-competitive. What does a non-competitive atmosphere bring to the table versus, you know, maybe another type of facility that other people are contemplating?
Right. So, and that's, I guess, where it's interesting. Like you said, you have to kind of choose a specific sport as you get older. A lot of times parents haven't had the opportunity to put their child in gymnastics until they're 8 or 9. And at that point, if they don't have the skills at a certain level, they're behind. Whereas with our classes, we work with the child where they're at. And that's where promoting their self-confidence and independence comes into play. Our oldest class, we call it our JETS, and they're kind of like our performance team. So now we'll be working on showing off the skills that they've been working on in a performance setting. We will hopefully be performing at a basketball game this coming season at the high school, just kind of giving them that opportunity to be in front of a crowd, but not needing to compete with others.
So we've talked a little bit about the four-month-old, the early classes, which obviously have parents involved. At what age do we start seeing kids that get dropped off? And in those kinds of classes, what is the sort of student-to-instructor ratio?
Yes, so our ratio across the board is 1 to 10. We keep it below that, especially with our small space and making sure we're clean and safe. As soon as the child is 3 years old, they would join one of our drop-off classes. That's a one-hour drop-off class. Once they're potty independent, they're able to join us for one of our holiday camps or the Friday afternoon power play or the parent survival nights.
So you've been able to take this business and start to grow it. One thing you mentioned was your instructors, and I know for many small business owners, finding instructors in this finding employees in this environment is hard. For yourself, you're looking for even a more niche skill set. How has it been finding people to help staff?
You know, I feel very grateful. I have an amazing team. For me, it's mostly been word of mouth. I feel very strongly that you should love what you do, and I try to teach my young instructors this. So it's important to know how to have a work-life balance. So we have a good little crew of, there's only about 6 of us, and we teach them the specifics on what to teach. So the first thing is you have to love children. And it's a process to come in and make sure that it is something you love and something that will make not only the child happy that you're teaching, but you get joy from it as well. So yeah, I've been very fortunate to have an amazing team. There have been times where it's been hard to find people, but luckily we have been making it work.
You know, last year when things were pretty much shut down, tell us a little bit about how you coped and what you were able to do during that period.
Yes, that was not easy for anyone. We kind of just hunkered down and offered our private, more smaller, intimate classes. We did, right after quarantine, we hosted like mini camps with a very small group of parents that felt comfortable sending their kids to us, especially when school was out of session. It was still important for children to get out and move and be around other kids. So we made it work.
It also looked like perhaps you did some activity lists for at home. I think on Facebook I saw some items that you know, people could do at home when we were really locked down. Is that true?
Yes, we did the little gym at home. We filmed classes that you could do at home. It was something. It wasn't the same as being in the gym, but it was still something that we could offer while everyone was at home.
Well, Lena, we've really appreciated your time with us today. We've been speaking with Lena Singleton. She is the owner of Little Gym Park City. It's located right on Iron Horse Drive. Lena, can you let the listeners know the website, how they can find more information?
Yes, our website and our Instagram handle are the same. It's TLGParkCityUT.com. We also have an easy text number that you can text us for questions and direct links to book. We are starting our next 6-week session this coming week, and we will be hosting our youngest gymnast starting at 4-month-olds Thursdays at 11, which has been really exciting to get back on the schedule.
Lena, thank you. We've appreciated our time with you today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.